Today is Friday, April 8th, 2010. I'm Andrew Longhurst. This is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening, and thanks for being with us. On today's show, we bring you a special edition of News 101 focused on food security. First, we bring you a live interview with Elizabeth Quinn of the BC Association of Farmers Markets to discuss their Farmers Market Nutrition and Coupon Program, which will be canceled for the 2010 season due to a lack of funding. The program brought fresh local food to low-income people in the province. We'll also have an interview on the show with Andrew Pask, a planner at the City of Vancouver who focuses on food security, and we'll be discussing food security issues in the city and the region. All this on the show. We'll have this plus your free speech radio news headlines and your weekday weather forecast coming up this hour right here on News 101. And first, here are your free speech radio news headlines for Friday, April 8th.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Rescuers return back again today as they attempted to recover four miners from Massey Energy's Upper Big Branch coal mine in West Virginia. An explosion Monday killed 25. The four miners are still missing. The search team reached one rescue chamber but found the emergency food, water, and oxygen supplies untouched. As rescuers continued towards a second chamber, they encountered heavy smoke that signaled a fire deeper within the mine. President Obama spoke at the White House today about Monday's mine explosion.
It's a profession that's not without risks and danger, and the workers and their families know that. But their government and their employers know that they owe it to these families to do everything possible to ensure their safety when they go to work each day.
Failures in mine safety practices and enforcement are being investigated by the government. Obama says he's asked for a report from the Labor Department that will show what went wrong and why it went wrong so badly. Conservative Democrat Bart Stupak of Michigan announced today he will not seek a 10th term in the House of Representatives. The abortion opponent was a key player in moderate Democrats' efforts to win concessions from the Obama administration during the health care debate. Stupak was facing opposition from the Tea Party in his northern Michigan district. At a press conference, Stupak said neither this nor other health care backlash was a significant factor in his decision not to seek re-election. The largest hazardous waste dump in the West improperly disposed of waste known to cause cancer, according to a new finding from the Environmental Protection Agency. Locals in the nearby town of Kettleman Hills, California, blame the dump for birth defects. FSRN's Christina Onnested has more.
Chemical Waste Management has illegally disposed of toxic waste like PCBs and acetone at its Kettleman Hills landfill, according to a violation notice from the U.S. EPA. The EPA says this isn't the first time the company has been in violation of environmental laws. Chemical Waste Management failed to address past violations and was fined for improperly monitoring seepage of cancer-causing chemicals under the landfill. The hazardous waste dump sits adjacent to Kettleman Hills City, a small farming town in California's Central Valley, mostly inhabited by low-wage agricultural workers. Locals blame the landfill for the extremely high number of children born with birth defects in recent years. The EPA is now testing the soil in Kettleman Hills City for contamination. The landfill received a permit from the local government to expand, but that permit is now on hold as the EPA's investigation continues. Christina Onnestad, FSRN.
Local, state, and federal governments have failed to protect the rights of low-income and minority Gulf Coast residents in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. That, according to a condemning report released today by Amnesty International. FSRN's Zoe Sullivan reports from New Orleans.
The report states that recovery efforts following the 2005 hurricane often ignored poor and minority residents whose families have lived in the region for generations. Thousands of New Orleanians remain scattered around the country because they have been unable to return. One-third of the city's homes are still abandoned because homeowners have been unable to rebuild. The executive director of Amnesty International USA calls for the Stafford Act, the federal law governing disaster recovery, to be reformed. Seth Weingart of the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center agrees with this proposal.
Now we'd like to see Stafford Act reformed to change this duplication of benefits rule so that you can look at an individual situation and say, okay, this person, maybe they got this insurance settlement, but this money never went to the house, so we're not going to consider that a duplication of benefits, and we're going to give them assistance.
The Amnesty International report also cites shortfalls in healthcare access and persistent problems with law enforcement. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
Political turmoil continues in Kyrgyzstan today, but the leaders of the revolution, which ousted the current president, remained in control of the country. Despite calls from the opposition, the deposed Kyrg president refused to resign. The World Health Organization is on the ground in the Central Asian country, and spokesperson Paul Garwood said it's providing medicines and medical equipment.
It would make available medical equipment like forceps, stethoscopes, infant scales, other surgical equipment, along with medicines, including antibiotics, that could treat up to 1,500 cases.
And medical providers in Kyrgyzstan are going to need those supplies. The health ministry says more than 500 people have been injured in clashes with the government that began Wednesday. 76 people have died. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And thanks to FSRN for those headlines. Over the past 3 weeks, we have had the pleasure of having a high school intern here at CITR. Rabia Saida joins me in studio, and this comes as she's finishing up her internship here at CITR. 3 weeks, and Rabia, what was the experience like for you?
The experience has been wholly awesome. I came in here not really knowing much about radio or like any of the behind the scenes stuff. I just thought it was kind of cool, like, oh, you play music and you talk a little, but it's a lot more. There's so much work that goes into it, and it's been great. Everyone's been so welcoming, and I've had so much opportunity to just kind of explore at my own pace and everything, so it's been great.
And so you today were DJing a show. What was that like, a music show? What was that like?
That was pretty nerve-wracking. I'd never actually done it before, obviously, by myself, so it was pretty crazy. I mean, there's a few hiccups, but overall, it was good, and there was really good training sessions that I went to, so it's just kind of, it was good. Like, everything was explained, and I'd love to do it for, later.
So, coming out of this experience, are you thinking that you want to pursue broadcasting?
Yeah, it definitely seems like an avenue that I want to explore and go into. Right now, it's pretty open-ended for anything, but this has given me a really good look at it, and I'd love to go into something like that.
And you've definitely been super helpful around with the news department. What were your observations? Working on the news and seeing how community and student news is produced.
It's been pretty awesome, especially with the interviews and that sort of thing. I mean, I gained a lot more skills just in that, where it's not, the same type of questions. Like, you actually dig deep into an issue that's not explored by some other types of media. And it's been really cool to see all the work that actually goes into it to, just an hour. There's a lot of grunt work and that's kind of research involved.
Cool. Well, We hope to see you around in the future. Hopefully you'll be at UBC and you'll be a face around the station. So thanks again for helping us out, and really appreciate it, and best of luck to you in the future.
Thanks so much, and thanks for having me here.
Our pleasure. Rabia Saida, who just finished up an internship here at CITR, and we have been so grateful to have her around here helping us out. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're going to take a quick break for some public service announcements. After that, we've got an interview with Elizabeth Quinn. She is the manager at the BC Association of Farmers Markets. We're going to be talking about food security in the city. Stay with us.
AMS Speakeasy provides information, peer counseling, and crisis support to the UBC community. Speakeasy volunteers are carefully chosen and trained to assist students in dealing with a wide range of issues, including relationship breakups, substance abuse, sexuality, and exam stress. To access our service for information or counseling, drop in to visit our desk on the north side of the sub-concourse. All drop-ins and call-ins are strictly confidential. We also have an online email referral service. If we can't help you, we can refer you to someone who can.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. A. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
And welcome back. This is News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Elizabeth Quinn of the BC Association of Farmers Markets now joins us on the line to discuss the Farmers Market Nutrition and Coupon Project, which will be canceled for the 2010 season due to a lack of funding. And Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us live on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, so can you first off tell us what the association does, what the BC Association of Farmers Markets does, and why it's important in BC?
Well, the BC Association of Farmers Markets, we're an association of member markets. So, you know, 95% of the farmers markets in BC are members of our association. And so we help to deliver a unified industry voice to government and to other industry groups. So without that unified voice, it's really hard to be heard if you're just a one individual market in the province.
And now, how many farmers markets does the association represent in BC?
Well, right now we have about 91 markets that we represent, and there's probably about 110 markets, and every year I'm getting new phone calls. I'm getting phone calls from people who are saying, how do I start a farmer's market? Please tell me how to do it. So it's actually a booming. It's booming.
Now,
the interest, yeah.
How many tend to be in the Lower Mainland, and how many are in other parts of the province?
Well, we have five markets just in Vancouver alone that are members, including UBC Farm Market and all the, you know, Trout Lake and Kitsilano, West End, and I can't think of the other one. So there's five in Vancouver alone. And then they're in Abbotsford and Coquitlam. They're all over. They're in the north as well. We have probably about 8 or 10 members in the north, where you wouldn't think there was much farming going on, but there are farmers.
Now, the BC Association of Farmers Markets had a quite an innovative program called the Nutrition and Coupon Project, and this provided food for local food for low-income people in the province. Can you explain a little bit more about exactly this, more of the specifics about the project?
Well, it's
and also talk about why there's no funding available for the 2010 season.
Okay, so what was so unique about our program was that we were offering coupons to low-income women who are pregnant or low-income families with children. And they also were attending a skill-building program where they were learning to cook or learning about nutrition. Many of them expanded into growing their own community gardens, and they learned how to can. And then they would get these coupons for participating in the skill building program, and then they would take the coupons to a farmer's market, and they were able to buy fruits and vegetables, meat and dairy, cheese and fish. And for a lot of these people, they had never been to a farmer's market. Have you been to a farmer's market?
I have. I have numerous times, and I love them. And
I know. They're so much fun.
Yeah.
So for some of them, some of these people are new Canadians. So it's a part of Canadian culture that they didn't know about. And other people have, you know, they were born in Canada. But for most of the people, they were really pleasantly surprised at how enjoyable the experience was. And for some of them, it reminded them their own community markets in their own countries. So it brought a feeling of community to their life that they hadn't expected. And then they also got to meet farmers, and then they also got to taste a lot of produce that they weren't accustomed to, like kale and chard, or other types of like heirloom tomatoes or specialty heritage apples. And they bring their children, and their children were able to, you know, choose some of the fruits and vegetables themselves. So it ended up being a really enjoyable experience for them.
Now, who largely funded this project in previous years, and why for this year is there a lack of funding?
Well, it was completely funded by the BC Ministry of Employment and Income Assistance, and then they turned into the Ministry of Housing and Social Development. They kindly gave us two years of funding, and it was a grant. And they said at the beginning that it would be finite. There would be no funding after the 2 years ran out. So we knew all along that they would not give us more funding, but we were hopeful that they might change their mind. So we didn't lose our funding. It just ended.
And is there any chance? Well, what has the response from the ministry been? Has there been any response? Have you asked them why the funding was ended abruptly like this, and there's no chance for future funding? Or sort of, can you characterize the relationship between the ministry and the association?
Well, there was a steering committee. It's called the Nutrition Coupon Steering Committee, and it was made up of representatives from the Ministry of Health, Ministry of Housing and Social Development, and Ministry of Healthy Living and Sports, and the Ministry of Agriculture, and they had a rep from Vancouver, City of Vancouver. We had someone from Fresh Choice Kitchens, who's very, you know, knowledgeable about community kitchens around the province. So all these ministry people knew that we were going to run out of funding, but they are all in the same kind of situation we are, in that their ministries' budgets have been cut dramatically. So they were keeping us up to date because we met with them every month for 3 years. So it's not like we have a good relationship with those ministries, and their budgets were cut as well.
So is there any chance that funding will be restored in future years?
We got a phone call last week from one of the ministries, I won't say which one, saying there's a possibility now, but we won't know until the end of April. And this was, you know, out of the blue. They contacted us because there's so much interest in this program, and so many people think it's like it's perfect to address food security issues.
Well, and that's what I would say. This is bad PR for the ministry, right? Like, this is in a time when people are often facing the inability to buy food and be able to feed themselves at a level that is what they need for nourishment.
Well, and it also fits into the ministries, like the Ministry of Healthy Living and Sports. It's their part of their mandate to address food security issues or food insecurity issues throughout the province. And so they do have a fruit and vegetable program where they're reaching out to remote communities. And so this is something that the government promised in 2000 and, I don't know, a couple of years ago. So I was just reading on their website. I've known about it because it's been part of the updates on our steering committee phone calls, but they're going to be having a program in Zabalas and Masset and Bella Coola and Dease Lake, Telegraph Creek, Port Clements, Tassis. So these are all very remote communities, and maybe we'll be able to continue our program. But we'll find out at the end of April, which is, like I'm saying, hot off the press, but I can't tell you which ministry until I find out for sure that we get some funding, and it would only be for this year.
Before we let you go, I want to ask you, just in a general sense, what is food security like in BC and in Vancouver? Because often, for those of us who do have enough food to eat and have that privilege, we often aren't faced with issues of food insecurity, but many people in the province are, and many people in our own communities are faced with issues of food insecurity. How does BC rank in terms of the way it addresses food security? And obviously, losing these types of programs is not helpful in addressing this.
You know, that's such a big question. I don't know myself how well BC rates compared to other provinces. I do know that when we did have this coupon program, it actually was for 3 years. The first year was a pilot. We were the only province that had this type of program, linking low-income families with farmers markets and fresh local produce. And I don't know if we could ever provide people with everything they need. And so I don't know the answer to your question. I think it's, I don't know how we're doing as a province. I do know that we have the highest rate of child poverty in Canada. So, and I'm not sure why.
Well, Elizabeth, I guess we'll leave it at that. And best of luck with funding for the program. It sounds like a remarkable program, and sorry to hear that funding has been lost. And thanks again for joining us on this Friday evening.
Yeah.
And we'll hopefully talk to you soon, hopefully when maybe that funding has been restored.
Well, yes, and thanks for calling, because this helps get the word out. It's very, very helpful having people learn more about the nutrition coupon program.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth.
Thanks a lot. Okay,
take care. Bye-bye. That was Elizabeth Quinn, manager of the BC Association of Farmers Markets, speaking to us about their coupon program, which helped low-income people access fresh, local, nutritious foods. And the funding for that program was recently cut. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're actually going to close the show off and leave you with quite a lengthy interview with Andrew Pask, a planner at the City of Vancouver. This past week, he and I discussed food security issues and food security initiatives in the city. We're going to leave you with that interview. This is News 101, and be sure to tune in this coming Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca, and we hope to be providing you more independent coverage in the future. So stay tuned. And this is an interview again with Andrew Pask from the City of Vancouver. This is News 101. So I'd like just to start off with asking you about your role at the City of Vancouver and what type of planning you do and how much of your time you spend on food policy and food security issues.
Sure. Just about me in particular, or do you mean how much time the city spends on these sorts of...
Both, if you could go into that, yeah.
Okay. Sure. Well, my name is Andrew Pask. I work in the city's social policy division, which is part of the community services group at the city. That's a group that looks at planning and social planning issues and a number of community development initiatives. And I've been here for about 5 or 6 years. The work that I do is focused on a bit of a mixed bag of activities. So some of my work is focused on food policy initiatives. Some of it is focused on a variety of other things that my division is involved in. Everything from youth outreach to the development of child care facilities to a whole number of other things. So food policy is, it's fair to say food policy is a substantive component of my work. It's something that is a real priority for the city right now, and I've been working on a variety of these issues for the last, 4 or 5 years. The city itself has been becoming increasingly involved in food policy and food security initiatives since I've been at the city. I think it's fair to say this is reflective of an increased awareness, not just within Vancouver, but in North America and further abroad, about the role of food security and the importance of food production.
Now, what's your background in terms of your planning background? I'm just curious about where you did your degree and why for you this is an important issue.
Sure. Okay. Well, my little academic trajectory started not in planning at all, but in communications and environmental issues back in the 90s. I spent some time doing a graduate degree in anthropology in Holland, and then got into the business of doing community planning work in municipalities in Ontario, and then went back to school to do a degree in planning in Toronto. So I guess from there I moved out to British Columbia about 6 years ago now, and worked with some nonprofits, and then ended up at the city about 5 years ago. I think, an answer to your question around why I think food security is important, I'd flip the question around. I mean, how is it not important? I mean, it seems to be sort of a touchstone issue that connects us to so many other facets of, sustainability questions. How we gather, how we convene ourselves socially, how we treat the planet, and so on and so forth. It's sort of an issue that spans everything. It's a basic need that fuels our culture, and as such, I think as far as city planning goes, it's something that represents an important area for local governments to be involved with as well.
Now, how does the City of Vancouver define food security?
Well, the approach was made a few years ago, I think going as far back as 2003, which was before I was at the city, to look at the role of the food system. And so the city has always had an interest in making sure that food security and the food system were understood in a holistic way. The initial language around the food system, or the council motions that got the ball rolling, so to speak, were to investigate what was required to enable a just and sustainable food system in Vancouver. So there was a real moral component to things, first of all, that idea of a just food system, equity and so on, and sustainable as well. And that was back in 2003. And at that point in time, I think, it's fair to say that the work was exploratory. There were examples of different types of involvement that various local governments were engaging in with regard to the food system across North America and elsewhere, but it was not something that was on the radar for all cities. To say the least, I think it was pretty new in that sense. It's also one of those areas that, as far as local governments go, has always resulted in questions around jurisdiction. Is food something that local governments should be taking on as part of their mandate, or is that something that properly rests elsewhere? People often think of food in terms of agriculture, and agriculture, conventionally speaking, has been the responsibility of upper levels of government. That being said, Vancouver did decide to explore the potential roles that it might play. As a result of that activity in 2003, they struck a task force to scope out the nature of the work. That task force in turn recommended the creation of a citizens body comprised of experts in the field that could represent various different components of the food system. And from that, the Vancouver Food Policy Council was created in 2004. So that was one of the first steps there, was to actually get experts around the table who could advise the city on how best to proceed.
Now, can you specifically talk about what the Vancouver Food Policy Council does and sort of their role in the planning process?
Sure. Well, they I think when they started, they were given a fairly broad mandate to try and look at issues of, again, that sort of holistic, just and sustainable food system, which is pretty big. I mean, it's a fairly big thing to look at. And so they did the right thing. They spent a bit of time sort of teasing that out and figuring how they best could plug into things. They are an arm's length advisory body. And so as such, they're volunteer based. These are people that work, some of them work in food production, some of them work in food processing, some of them have involvement with organizations that look at waste issues, food waste and so on. So they come from various different components of the food system. They spent some time trying to define their role, coming up with the terms of reference, figuring out how they may plug into things. The broad mandate of any city advisory body is to provide council and staff with advice on particular issues, policy directions, and so on and so forth. So there's always been sort of an automatic relationship, if you like, with city council and with existing staffing at the city, the sort of bureaucratic side of things around food policy. So there's been that role. And then as well, the Food Policy Council, I think, they also decided to try and flesh out their role and figure out what types of things they could be involved in that fit the mandate, but also fit the broad goals of creating a just and sustainable food system. So they looked at the idea of creating, for example, some research products around food security in Vancouver, and they were involved with a number of projects trying to define, the state of food security in the city. They looked at the creation of a food charter which was a council endorsement, a charter that was signed off and proclaimed by council around the principles that are attached with a just and sustainable food system. And that was something that involved community input and a lot of revisions and some really good work around trying to clarify this language, because everyone talks about food security, but there's all sorts of different definitions and understandings of the term. So I would actually refer you, if you're interested, I'd refer you to that document to look at it, because I think it's very well composed.
Did the Food Charter give council an opportunity to pursue food security initiatives further? Did it serve as an impetus for action?
I think it's fair to say that it's, the way the charter functions is that it becomes one of those things that, it acts as something that, because it's endorsed, it has gravity in that sense. So, it sets a sense of direction for the city. It's not the type of thing that has specific policy recommendations in there, and it's not the type of thing that has the sort of, legally binding apparatus that a bylaw does. But what it does do is it says, here's, broadly speaking, here's our intentions. This is what we're about. And this is, this is our take on food security and why we think it's important. And, it's more a statement of principles and values. As such, it's foundational in the sense that, presumably everything that flows from the city in terms of food security related initiatives should, in a way, if not directly reference, if not directly reference this document, it should have some consistency with it. You should be able to see the flow from one to the other.
Okay, well, maybe let's talk about specific programs and initiatives at the City of Vancouver in terms of food security and community involvement in food security issues. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could start out by giving us sort of a history of food security initiatives and then bring us up to the present day, and we can discuss more current projects?
Sure. Okay. Well, the whole notion of history and food security in Vancouver is an interesting one, because, we've talked about food security in a reasonably sort of contemporary fashion, food security in the last decade or so within the City of Vancouver. But the interesting thing is that Vancouver, like many other cities in the Lower Mainland and in Canada, had a quite a rich history in terms of food security in the past. Once the territory that is now Vancouver was logged out, farming was a very key activity, and some of the best farms in BC, some of the most productive, best soil was found within the city along the Fraser River there. You had some fantastic orchards that were in place, and some very substantive farming initiatives that were established. So I think that's, in a way it's kind of interesting that there's this focus again on creating productive city spaces, agriculturally productive city spaces, because it's kind of like what's old and is new again,
And now we're going to take a quick break for the weather. And in studio, Denise Dyadic, I always get the pronunciation wrong. Denise, what's in store for us?
Well, the sun is finally out again. We've got a cold but clear spring forecast ahead. Here's your weekend weather for April 9th to 11th. Tonight should be mostly clear with areas of frost and a low of 1 degree. Saturday will be mostly sunny with some cloudy periods, high of 11 and a low of 1. Sunday should be the same, a mix of cloud and sun with some morning frost, high of 12 degrees and a low of 1. And here's the answer to last week's trivia question. The only difference between typhoons and hurricanes is the location where they form. Typhoons form in the Northwest Pacific, and hurricanes form anywhere in the Atlantic. Both storms can be very catastrophic. And here's this week's weather trivia fact. A about tree crickets. Tree crickets are called the poor man's thermometer because temperature directly affects the rate of activity. Count the number of chirps a cricket makes in 15 seconds, then add 37. The sun will be very close to the outside temperature, but in Fahrenheit. That's your forecast for the weekend, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. Currently, it's 5 degrees and clear at YVR. For News 101, I'm Denise Diotic.
And thank you, Denise, for that forecast. We're going to return to our coverage, this interview with Andrew Pask, planner at the City of Vancouver, in a discussion I had with him this past Wednesday on food security in Vancouver.
Maybe if we look at Dunbar and Killarney, which are now the neighborhoods where some of those productive farms are, we know perhaps that there's the opportunity because there's some history there of their past productivity in that sense. But of course, when the city grew up, other industries moved in, farms were displaced and pushed out to the valley, the residential population grew, and so on and so forth. But that whole notion of history is stayed with us. And if you look at Victory Farms during the war, and I hope I'm not sort of taking us too far off your question by referencing them, but
no.
there was a real interest in urban farming at that point in time, although that I don't know that term was necessarily used. Victory Farms were huge. They started in North America. They seemed to be far more popular in the States at the beginning. There was a bit more resistance in Canada to starting them, but eventually the federal and local governments got on board, and particularly around 1942, 1943, residents in Vancouver were really encouraged to grow gardens, and you had big window displays in Hudson's Bay, for example, that were promoting the activity. The local government and the mayor got behind it as well, and I think at that point in time there were well over 12 or 13, 1,400 gardens throughout the city, Victory Gardens. Very, very few remnants of those initial gardens remain today. In fact, there's the Arbutus Corridor Community Garden. It's one of the original sites. But most of them went away, and they sort of went into this lull. And then community gardens started to reemerge in the 70s and 80s. And there was, I think, perhaps as a result of, who knows, some of the countercultural trends at that time, a bit of the back to the land movement and so on. There was a renewed interest in this. The environment was becoming a far more prominent issue at that time. You had all sorts of books that had surfaced, everything from Rachel Carson's Silent Spring to the work of Barry Commoner and others, 60s and 70s environmental literature that were getting people more attuned to the importance of local food, but it was still quite a struggle, and so the city's food initiatives and programs of food security, by and large, have really begun to resurface in the last decade or so. We had community gardens coming on stream in the 70s and 80s, but other than that, there wasn't a huge amount. We had various city programs like the Carnegie Center set up with some food distribution and components, but it was small scale. And then all of a sudden, in the 90s and into the 2000s, you see a bit of a shift. And so once the Food Policy Council was set up in 2004, very quickly after that, you had a city initiative around hobby beekeeping. You had some research around food system assessments. You had in 2006 the first materials produced to try and encourage edible landscaping in the city. You had the food charter produced in 2007, and various design guidelines around promoting urban agriculture were in development from that point in time. You had in 2006 the launch, I think it was 06 or maybe it was 07, the launch of 2010 by 2010 Community Garden Challenge, which was trying to boost numbers around community garden plots. Right. He was trying to encourage people to get on board there.
Can you actually go specifically into that
sure.
program?
What would you like to know?
Talk about the challenge itself, and
sure.
This year was the year that challenge was met.
Yeah.
So if you could just talk about that a bit.
Sure. Well, it was started under the previous council, Councillor Peter Ladner at the time. I can't remember the date, but I'm just going to say it was either late 2006 or 2007. Had council endorse a challenge, which they called the 2010 by 2010 Community Garden Challenge, and the idea was pretty simple. It was, let's see if we can challenge residents to create 2010 new community garden plots. I want to emphasize we're talking about plots, not actual gardens itself. 2010 new plots by 2010. And so that challenge was issued some 3 years ago. Community groups and civic officials and some nonprofits and a whole bunch of folks basically got together and created, I think the last count we had as of January 1st was somewhere in the order of about 2,050 new garden plots. So we actually exceeded the challenge. And this was, you know, there was a community garden put on City Hall property last year. There were plots created all throughout the city. And it was really a way to encourage people to think about urban agriculture and community gardening, a way to build up the number of community gardens and to get people more engaged with food production.
Now, do you have numbers on the number of hectares those plots represent?
You know, I keep thinking that would be a very good thing to measure. There is, frankly, a bit of fluidity around the size of plots. That people have registered. Generally speaking, you know, community garden plots, they have a bit of a range. Sometimes you get some massive community garden plots, but generally speaking, you know, you're looking at 40, 50, sometimes 100 square feet. I mean, it really depends. So there isn't an actual benchmark at this point around that, and I was just having a conversation with one of our urban agriculture research folks earlier today that actually getting the area of these things measured would be a great next step. But no, we don't have that right now.
Right, and I assume after that stage, then you could look at the productive capacity of what we have existing land cultivated.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good next step, too. I mean, I can say, to be fair, that, you know, we did ask people to send in photos of their gardens and so on and so forth. So, you know, no one registered anything that it didn't really look like a community garden. So they all are sort of fairly conventional plots in that respect. No one's, you know, registered a bit of soil in a bucket or anything like that. The other exciting thing that I can tell you is sort of an adjunct to this is that we've got a number of other gardens that are currently in the works. So it's, you know, as I said, this initiative was started with the previous council, but the present council has been incredibly supportive of food security issues in the city. And we've got a number of new community gardens in the works, and we've certainly got a desire to keep going, to make more, because they are so popular. I mean, I look, one of the things that I do in my capacity at the city here is I field inquiries from people around starting community gardens, and the demand for them is just, you know, it's fantastic. There's, I think, every garden in the city has a wait list on it, and in some cases a fairly substantive wait list. Often gardens will cap them simply because, you know, there's so many people that they can't conceivably attend to all of the new folks that want garden plots in the next couple of years. So,
what is the process for getting a garden plot, and what's the relationship with the city and or working with Parks Board and the planning department with planting up? Is there a policy around planting up green space in parks?
Yeah. Well, there is, and in fact, so one of the things that's a little challenging for folks on the outside to see is that the city, of course, is it's not necessarily a monolithic entity. So we have inside the city, we have different departments that work on various issues related to land. essentially, and you've got the Parks Board, which has a number of land holdings. You've got a real estate department and an engineering department, each of which have different land holdings in the city. And so, in some cases, you know, thinking here of the Parks Board, there's a set policy around community gardens on parks land, and that's been a policy that's been in place for a number of years. And typically, up till recent years, most community gardens were actually on parks land, and so the Parks Board has a process in place for that. But some of the new gardens that are in the works right now, for example, are on real estate and engineering lands, and so. There is an effort afoot to try and make to try and ensure that the policies are at least synchronous with one another around the types of requirements that are involved. So, at present, you know, one of the things that that is required of people that want to start a community garden on parks land, and this goes also for the city hall garden, so other types of city land, is that you need to be a registered nonprofit. And this is a way of just ensuring some measure of accountability, that there's an organizational structure in place that will oversee the garden. As far as getting a plot in any of the gardens that exist, we have, I'm trying to remember the actual number of gardens around the city, but just make up a figure here, about 60, say, at least. They're usually operated by an individual nonprofit. So all of them will have their own wait lists, and because they're all locally based and neighborhood based, you know, you might apply to one or two in your neighborhood, and they will have their own wait list, and you'll have to contact them directly. So there's no, at present, there's no centralized registry around signing up for a community garden.
Okay. And let's talk more about urban agriculture in a larger scale. The UBC farm is the only urban farm within the it's not actually in the city, but in the area, I should say.
Yep.
There's not a lot of land in Vancouver for larger scale farming operations. Is community gardening and our community garden plots the main way that the city wants to achieve a greater level of food security?
Well, I mean, in terms of there's different ways to look at the whole role of food security. So, in terms of the idea of local production, you know, that's certainly that has been a key focus. We don't want to rule out things like urban farming, and I think it's fair to say that the city is open and receptive to looking at ideas around all sorts of things. And we're trying to figure out ways to enable this. So, you know, there are policies actually in the hopper right now that attempt to do this through other means. So, you know, we just had in front of council yesterday, in fact, a set of proposed guidelines around allowing the keeping of backyard hens. So that may be another way, for example, that we can bolster food security in this city by allowing people to have a few laying hens that can produce eggs, for example. You know, looking beyond community gardens is also part of the deal. But community gardens play a big piece of this, and I think you identified a good point. Vancouver has been, compared to a lot of other cities that have, you know, a more substantial land base. I was just in Edmonton a few weekends ago, and it's an enormous city with a huge footprint. And Vancouver is much smaller and far more compact and far more built out than that sort of city. So our constraints are a bit different, and I think thankfully we can't sprawl away some of these other cities have. On the other hand, we may not have the same opportunities for things like urban farming that other places do as well. And now, because we're so compact and because real estate values are what they are, that also puts other limitations on things.
What's the relationship with Metro and other municipalities when working on issues of food security? Because obviously it's not an issue that is only relevant within the boundaries of the city of Vancouver. It's an issue that obviously affects the whole region. So maybe you could talk about the relationship with Metro, other municipalities,
sure.
And just the regional strategy for greater food security.
Yeah. Well, I suppose if you had to characterize the relationship, you might say something like it's a bit multifaceted in the way that it plays out. So, you know, when it comes to specific policies like backyard hens or beekeeping or community gardens and stuff like that, the city of Vancouver, I think it's fair to say that we dialogue with other municipalities. We've certainly tried to glean from the experience of other municipalities, and sometimes that means our local neighbors, and sometimes it means chatting with other municipalities further afield that, you know, may be taking a particularly progressive bent on one issue or another, and how that works. So there's that, and I do know there's been a lot of reciprocal interest in what the city of Vancouver is doing. I mean, we're actually, you know, we're seen as being quite a progressive municipality, and so on the issue of backyard hens, for example, I fielded an awful lot of inquiries from other municipalities, both in the immediate vicinity, but also across BC around what we were doing with backyard hens and how things are playing out in terms of, you know, the various bylaw amendments that would need to be considered and the type of guidelines that were being considered and so on. So there's stuff like that, right? I mean, it's sort of the one-off particular policy issue dialogue that takes place.
And I want to ask you two questions about the transportation of food. How dependent, just generally speaking, how dependent is Vancouver on food being transported from other locations, either within the valley or other provinces, or even obviously coming across the border? Yeah. And then secondly, when food policy is being implemented and food security planning is being conducted, is transportation planning considered at the same time? Are these really intrinsically separate planning issues?
Well, I think actually it might be more reasonable to say that they're intrinsically linked planning issues, but that historically there has been a separation. You know, the whole dialogue around food miles is a fairly new one for a lot of folks, and I think a fairly new one for planners and engineers in particular. But it's a critically important one. I mean, your first question was how dependent are we, and I think we should make absolutely no mistake that right now we are utterly dependent on importing food from the region, from Fraser Valley, from other parts of Canada, from the U.S., and internationally. I mean, you only have to go to your grocery store and start rooting through, you know, the list of you know, the labels on the, you know, in the produce section, for example, to see how far afield some of our food travels. I don't think we need necessarily to go as far afield with all our food. I mean, some of it is around consumer demand for certain things, and there's certainly work that can be done there to try and get people thinking a little bit more critically around whether or not they need to have, you know, various fruits and vegetables in season all year round, because being in season all year round means bringing up something from Chile when, in fact, maybe if you just wait a few months, it'll be here and it'll be local. So, you know, there's that component of it as well. But, you know, one of the things that's being looked at right now by the city, it's in a report that just got produced by the city earlier this year called Towards a Bright Green Future. Current council has this this ambition to make the city of Vancouver, I think, one of the greenest city in the world by 2020. And one of the components of this endeavor is around food, and it, you know, they've got a metric in place that looks at things like carbon footprints attached with food. Now, there are different ways to measure things, and you know, there may be all sorts of other measures to use. But I think the idea of a carbon footprint is an interesting one, because it does start to open up a bit of a discourse around some of the you know, the issues around transportation that you identified around food miles and things like that.
And generally speaking, how many days of food does Vancouver have if there was a serious disaster, catastrophic natural disaster disrupting transportation routes, or if there were other disturbances to the urban and regional systems?
Yeah, I don't have an exact figure in that sense, but I would say not very many.
Okay.
You know, if we were all of a sudden cut off and set adrift, for example, yeah, I don't know. But I don't think a lot of days.
Okay.
And I think it would be sort of on the scale of days, and maybe perhaps a couple of weeks, but beyond that, I don't know.
Right.
I'm not sure, though, so I don't know if I feel hugely qualified to answer that question.
Okay. Well, any other, I'll let you go. Are there any other final thoughts? Not to end on a dreary note.
Not to end on that disaster scenario.
That's
but,
right.
Well, I think it's great that you're covering this issue, because, you know, one of the things that that has been apparent to me is that the interest and awareness in food issues is growing, and I think if we're going to really do ourselves socially and culturally